The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, those of you who have been here the last couple of times that I've been here will recall that for Martin Luther King's birthday Monday, I talked about Martin Luther King's teachings on love. And then last week, I talked about the history of this very, I think, powerful verse by the Buddha on love and how it played down through history, including right here in San Francisco in the 1950s. And so it's kind of like on a theme about love these days. And so I think I'd like to just keep doing that. And I think for the next while that I'm here, I'd like to talk about some of the more particular teachings on love in Buddhism that's known by the name, or the word, the Pali Sanskrit word, Brahma Viharas, the four kinds of love that are championed or deeply valued in Buddhism. And it'll take going to be a while to get through them because I'm going to be the intermittent talks. I'm here. I'm away on retreat for a couple of retreats over the next while. So when I'm here, I'll pick up that theme. And so there are four kinds of love that are promoted in Buddhism. And they are called Brahma Viharas. And these four kinds of love, I think of them as the four faces of the heart. And depending on which face you direct, you get a different emotion, different love to direct to the world. And this idea of that there's four faces to the heart comes from Buddhist and Hindu mythology, that one of the great gods of the Indian pantheon was a god named Brahma. And Brahma is said to have four faces on his head. And you see, some in Asia, sometimes like in Thailand, you see statues of this god, and he actually has four, you know, made with four faces, you know, one in the front, one in the back, and one on each side. And these four faces represent these four forms of love, which the god Brahma dwells in. The god has created great karma and been born in this wonderful divine sphere that is characterized as a place to dwell in what's metta, karuna, mudita, and upekkha. And those are the Pali words for these four kinds of love, sometimes translated into English as loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity. And because this god dwells in these beautiful states of love, and the word for dwell or abide is vihara. And so they're called Brahma Viharas, the dwellings of Brahma. And some people into English will translate it as divine abidings, because Brahma is kind of a divinity. They call these divine abidings, which is kind of nice to take it away from a literal god, the mythology, and to, you know, if we take divine as being, you know, not so much having to do with the heavens so much, but having to do with something that's really superb or sublime or, you know, pretty special for us. And so there's four of them. And the first one is usually translated as loving kindness. Metta is, in our tradition, is considered to be the primary one, which is the foundation for the other three. And metta is the basic goodwill, friendly goodwill, friendliness we can have towards other people. Goodwill meaning we want them well. We want to see them do well. We want them to be happy. And it doesn't necessarily mean something sentimental, which sometimes is suggested maybe by the word loving kindness. It's a basic intention or wish for someone else's welfare and happiness. But goodwill is a nice translation for it, but it kind of, the word goodwill is kind of a nice word, but it doesn't have the word love in it, or it doesn't have the word kindness in it, which kind of, for some people, is kind of evocative of a certain aspect of this. But one of the aspects about this metta, this goodwill and loving kindness, is it has something that's called its near enemy. And the near enemy of love is the is a state that looks like it, but is not. That is actually kind of the opposite, or, you know, not quite, you know, not love. And the near enemy of love, this kind of goodwill, this kind of loving kindness or kindness, is has to do with selfishness, where there's a desire or a wish for some kind of energy, some kind of attention, something from someone else that's mostly about pleasure for ourselves. So sometimes when we're attracted to someone or want to be with someone, the primary attraction might be for what we're going to get. We might get pleasure from that person or attention. Some people, you know, really like to get attention. And if someone comes with great loving attention on you, it's pretty good. Like, I'll take more of that. And, you know, and so I think I love this person. because that would be very different from metta, which is not about getting something for ourselves, security or status or well-being or attention or pleasure or something. But rather it's something we generate from ourselves, and it's the direction of the love is towards someone else. We want them to be well. We want them to have happiness and joy. And there's not so much concern about ourselves or getting something in the equation. So it's said to be kind of selfish, selfless, in that we're not self-concerned in what we get in return. In fact, this form of metta and goodwill is said to develop over time, as we practice it, into kind of a boundless goodwill that radiates out to all beings. And that goodwill, if it encounters suffering, gets morphed into compassion. The heart, maybe, or the heart simply, you know, turns a quarter degree, and then the face of compassion shines out. If that loving kindness runs into someone who is really happy and having a good time and successful, or just, you know, things are good fortune in their lives, it seems great, then sympathetic joy is appreciating that, celebrating that. Really feeling good for them, and may that continue to prosper, may the person continue to have such good fortune. Sometimes it's said that this sympathetic or appreciative joy is the most difficult form of love, because some people have envy or jealousy, or it's just kind of hard to kind of, you know, some people. And then if loving kindness, this metta, encounters someone who for whatever circumstances is going on, it's not appropriate to have loving kindness, to have compassion, or to have equanimity, that the love can still be there, but there's a balance of mind, there's a non-reactivity of mind. And that's sometimes said to be also very difficult to have, but also extremely profound, to be not caught in the drama of the person's life, but to stay balanced but keep the heart open at the same time. Some people are making difficult choices in their lives, and we love them, but it's not appropriate to go and save them all the time. It's not appropriate to act out of compassion. You might have goodwill, but it's not appropriate to act on it. There has to be some kind of equanimity that has to be there. We don't get swept up in the drama, and that's the appropriate thing. Some people need to be left alone so they can learn their own lessons, for example. So the you know, maybe a kind of a mundane example of these four forms of love is the for some people, if you encounter a really cute puppy, and you know, it's a really cute puppy, and just first, nothing's, you know, you don't know much about it except how cute it is, and so there might be kind of a heartwarming feeling of delight and joy and goodwill and kind of kindness or something for the puppy. And we don't expect anything in back from the puppy, just like, wow, just the heart kind of opens, kind of. If the puppy gets hurt, then there's compassion, there's care. You want to, you don't, you'd like to have alleviate that suffering. If the puppy is happily playing and frolicking on the ground, it's kind of delightful to see, and kind of you feel happy for the dog, and oh, you know, this is great, and there's sympathetic or appreciative joy is there, kind of joy in the joy of the dog. But if the puppy is you know, looking out the window at the squirrels, and is, you know, really eager and happy to want to go chase that squirrels, but then realizes it can't catch them, and then it gets so forlorn and crushed, you know, it's, you know, collapses to the floor. You know, you still love the dog, but you have this equanimity about that. You don't get caught up in the drama of the dog and its the squirrel thing. So that's kind of, you know, a mundane, maybe silly example, but maybe you get the idea of it. And so the idea in Buddhism is to value these sentiments or these intentions, these motivations that we have, these directions of the heart, and to notice them when they're there, to evoke them, to develop them, to strengthen them, so they become something that is ready at hand and become strengths that we carry with us into the world. They can be quite strong. And the idea that love can be strong, I think, is a very important thing, because it becomes something then becomes ballast, becomes a way of living in the world that's not tossed around by all the various things that can happen to us as we go through our life. But we're ready at hand to kind of meet the world as it is with goodwill. So so one of the things that we do in Buddhism is that we don't leave it for chance that as we stumble around the world that maybe, you know, accidentally we might end up feeling love for someone. You know, we've heard it's a good idea, and, you know, maybe it'll happen one day. And but rather it's something that, you know, we can not just leave to chance, but we can call upon. We can recognize it in ourselves. We can begin developing and strengthening it, and we can evoke it at times when it's useful to do. So so one of the ways that it's developed in Buddhism is by recognizing where it's already happening. Where do you love already? Where do you have a kind of selfless love? Where you have, you know, this kind of strong feeling of goodwill, of kindness to someone, or compassion, or joy, or equanimity, where is it easy for you to have it? And learn to recognize it there. And, you know, I've known people who, I don't know what the circumstances of their life was, maybe it was challenging, but the only person they can really have that, like, loving kindness for, and that really kind of touches their heart, is their dog. And so they think about their dog. I know a Buddhist monk who, when he develops and cultivates the meditation on loving kindness, he apparently there's a very cute monkey in Sri Lanka, and somehow that monkey, when he thinks of it, just kind of opens his heart, warms his heart, and so that's his starting point for connecting to it. But the idea, principle is to look where it's easy for you to have it. So something which is maybe natural, it could be your family, it could be a friend, it could be a partner, wherever it's easy to have. And then don't stop with that person. But the idea in Buddhism is then to learn the skill, the ability, to expand that outward to include more and more people, to universalize it. So it isn't so much to ignore the people we love and, you know, rush headlong into the world at large, but really start with where we love and then expand that to include more people. And that can be, you know, a long-term task to do it. And it takes time to learn to do that because, so the classic way that this is done is cultivated in meditation practice. And then in meditation, to be cultivating and looking and focusing on, for example, this loving kindness, choose someone who's easy to do. And then after you kind of focus on the intention, you focus on the feeling, you focus on the image of the person, kind of you develop an ability to have concentrated attention in the present moment on the subject of love. It's not much different than keep having concentrated attention on your breathing, which is a classic meditation practice. Many of the same issues that come up that make it difficult to be in the present moment come up around focusing on love. The mind is distracted, it thinks about other things, you have to bring it back. It takes a while to settle the agitated mind down, but at some point it gets settled down and focused, and then lo and behold, you have the experience of not just kind of a fragile, temporary feeling of love, but you're stabilized in a feeling, an attitude, an intention of goodwill. And now that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool to have kind of your mind is kind of, that's the subject of your mind, that's the of your heart. It's not leaving, it's kind of like nothing, it fills your attention. It's not so much. It's not so different, you know, than some of the attention places of attention we sometimes pour our awareness, and we're completely absorbed in something for a while, and you know, just that's all we're about. So I know some people watched the Super Bowl yesterday, and I think some people were pretty attentive during parts of it. And for, you know, maybe for a few plays, it was like that was their whole attention, was just Super Bowl mind. But imagine if your whole attention like that was on love mind. That's pretty cool. I think it's pretty phenomenal. But as we cultivate and develop it, and once it's stable and strong, so that's kind of the flavor of the heart, the flavor of the moment, flavor of being, so where we're abiding in, like Brahma, abiding in love, then take that and then begin to consider, can I now bring that feeling to other people? Can I bring it, I've done it now, I've stabilized it or focused on where it's easy, now can I do it where it's not so easy? Maybe just kind of easy. And because it's maybe only kind of easy, then the people begin to kind of, well, there's some issues there. You know, I like that person a lot, but there was that thing that person did, or what they said, or this or that, that kind of bothers me. And so then, well, I don't know if the person doesn't deserve my love, I don't want to do it. And then we get to grapple and consider all the blockages, all the things that get in the way of us wanting to care for them, to love for them, and to work through it. Maybe have arguments with ourselves and kind of find out, is it okay, can we find out how to love other people in this kind of open way, to have goodwill? And then as we develop it there, then the Buddhist practice of doing this is you go progressively to where it's more and more difficult. And when you finally get to what the tradition calls, in the ancient language, calls the enemy, and which the modern Western Buddhist teachers call the difficult person, at that point, you know, there might be take a long time before you really kind of feel like it's okay and it's safe and it's appropriate in the privacy of your meditation to open up your goodwill to them and have a boundless kind of radiating feeling of goodwill for that person. And in the process of doing that, a person is working through a lot of their reactions to people, their beliefs around people, their resentments, their angers, all kinds of things which keep the heart closed, keeps our goodwill and love from flowing. And that's a beautiful thing to do. It's a profound thing to do, to work through it. At some point, in the practice we do it and find out how to do that even for enemies, at that point the practice is said to be opened up kind of 360 degrees. It includes everything and can radiate in all directions without exception to anybody, no exception, nobody's left out. And then it's no longer called Brahma Viharas, but it's be called the immeasurables, without measure. Because now our love has no measure, it has no limit to it. It just radiates out. And it's one of the great experiences of life to sit in a field of love, of goodwill or metta, and have it just kind of feeling like it just glows and radiates outwards as if it has no boundaries and has no need from anybody. It doesn't require anything. It's just a strong, pulsing feeling of joy and delight. And the mind is focused and centered and concentrated on just that. It's not distracted, doesn't get pulled into other things, it's nothing, you know, just that. That's a wonderful thing. I mean, imagine that the human mind and heart of human being has that capacity to rest and bathe in an experience of kind of boundless love. It's a great thing to experience. In the ancient Buddhist texts, all this is described as something that's developed in meditation practice. So as that such, it's a practice, something we do when we focus on. Is it excessively sentimental? Is it unrealistic? Is it Pollyannish? Is it, is it artificial? When I first encountered this kind of practice and this kind of idea, I was disinterested in it because I thought it was artificial. And I ignored it. And my teachers would sometimes do guided meditations on loving kindness, and I tuned them out. And then at some point, as I went further and further into this mindfulness practice, the various blockages I had inside, the various limitations I had about my heart kind of relaxed, and my heart in a sense opened up, and I found myself bathed in this feeling and this radiating idea of goodwill and love. And that was kind of the primary character of my how I felt, was it just felt loving and kind, and this tremendous goodwill just sitting there kind of. And I was just surprised to sit there and see it well up. And not only did it well up, it wasn't just temporary, it wasn't just like fleeting and coming through. It was like there for quite a while. And then when the teachers did the guided meditations on loving kindness, I said, oh, that's what they're talking about. And it no longer was artificial. It was no longer something I had to kind of make happen. It was just, I recognized, oh, it's there, like that. And so when it comes that strong, it's a little bit like, if I can explain it, it's like a little bit like having a little space, if you had a little space heater that, you know, blasts out a little bit of heat, and you put it next to a huge furnace that just blasting out the heat. That little furnace, the little heater, space heater, it's not really going to make any difference. It's not really going to affect the furnace. Furnace is not going to care. So when your love is so strong, so powerful, it doesn't need love from other people. It's nice. Love from others, being loved by others is a wonderful thing. I don't want to shortchange it or say it shouldn't be there. But there isn't the need to. There isn't the need to have it. It isn't like we nurtured or, you know, it's not like a craving or an attachment that's needed, because the love that radiates from us is so much bigger. It's like strong. That's where we're established in. And so much so that I have a kind of a belief, maybe it's a little, maybe it's a strange idiosyncratic belief of my own, but it's a little bit based on seeing a lot of people who, long-time practitioners, long-time teachers of especially Buddhism, that it seems that my impression is that the more developed, the more mature a person becomes spiritually, the stronger the tendency to love, stronger the need it is to love, for us to love, and that's stronger than the desire to be loved. We might still be loved, but that's not where the need is, where the neediness is, where there's no hole to be filled, because we're so fulfilled with this kind of feeling of goodwill and love. It's a fantastic thing. So maybe it's developed in meditation. That's where it's easiest to do boundlessly, because when you're sitting quietly in meditation alone, people are uncomplicated. You know, it's much more complicated when you're with them. And that's where kind of, you know, the rubber hits the road kind of thing, you know, when you're with people. And it's, you know, it's complicated for many reasons. But to have the experience of a boundless loving heart in meditation, or boundless compassionate heart in meditation, gives a reference point for when we engage with people in the world, we know what's possible. And we have that reference point, we can see more acutely why it's not happening. So we see, you know, yes, I could in theory love this person, but I'm angry, or the person's a jerk. And then you say, well, you know, maybe I should look at that. Maybe I should kind of, you know, look at my judgments or my anger, and maybe I don't want to have that anger. Maybe I should see if I can see through it, and maybe I can find some way to meet this person in a different way. So one of the ways it plays out for me, this idea, is that there are some times I'm angry with people, and I have learned that if I'm in their presence, it's hard for me to maintain my anger. Because my anger is kind of made up out of my imagination, my stories, and my conversation I'm having with them. That at some point, if I spend too much time away from them having these conversations, reviewing what happens and all that, it begins kind of losing touch with reality. It's kind of like, you know, my little inner world. And so I've learned that when I'm angry with someone, to go find them and be in their presence and try to talk to them. Because I find that then I kind of see the multidimensional aspects of the person. That my mind and the story and my resentment, it's like two-dimensional, or it's probably a bit less than that. It's one-dimensional, my poor little mind, you know. And so, but if I'm with a person, it's kind of three-dimensional. And then I begin kind of softening, and I begin kind of seeing them in the different ways, and I feel kind of a different attitude. I don't hold my resentment the way I was before. That desire not to hold my resentment comes partly by knowing that it hurts me to have resentment or anger, and also comes from knowing that it's theoretically possible to be with this person and have love for them. And I would like to do that. How do we do it realistically? How do we do it so we take care of ourselves? Well, one way that I've learned is you don't tell them. They don't have to know. You can just have goodwill and love and just kind of privacy of your own inner life. And then, you know, you don't have the complications that arise if you tell them, and, you know, all kinds of things, you know, ways. So, you know, there's no obligation to tell them. And that's a nice little, you know. Or to know that there's a strength behind that love so we can take care of ourselves. We can say no. We can be confident and say, you know, this is as far as what I can do for you, but you know, to learn how to be with it. So the Brahma Viharas, these divine abidings, four forms of selfless love, and the fact that they're selfless, I suggest, gives them real depth inside of us, make them really a deep phenomena. Because selfishness, I think of as being kind of a surface phenomenon, a surface chatter of the mind that is active. But to really let go of that and drop into some deeper place inside, I think makes this love deep. And it becomes stable when it's not mixed up with greed, lust, desires, neediness, which kind of keeps the mind agitated and unstable. So to have this deep, stable sense of love that has this particular flavor. There's so many, the word love in English means so many different things for different people. But in Buddhism, it means one of these four states. State of deep goodwill or loving kindness, a state of compassion, a state of appreciative joy, and the state of equanimity. So what I'd like to do in these next times that I'm here is to hopefully give one talk on each of those. And so we can appreciate it better and understand it. And so you can maybe understand that these are fantastic resources. They have great value. In fact, the Buddha called them inner wealth. They're greater than any outer wealth that you can have, this inner wealth. And it's a nice wealth to have because it's portable. So those are my thoughts for today. And do you have any questions about that or any comments you'd like to make?
So sometimes when I'm doing metta practice, I'll get to the difficult person and there's like this roadblock.
Sorry?
And there's like this roadblock, right?
Yes.
And sometimes what I'll do is sort of turn that around and sort of ask myself, well, do I wish this person ill? And usually the answer is no. And that somehow seems to open up, create a space for some sort of metta goodwill to arise.
Very nice. Yeah. I'm angry, but do I wish this person ill will? Do I have ill will for the person? It's interesting that in this Theravadan Buddhist tradition, there's a very big 1,500-year-old book that's the meditation manual. You know, it's like 800 pages in English, the translation. It's a really, really big book. And they have a big chapter on practicing these Brahma Viharas, these four forms of love. And the biggest section is about loving kindness. And in that section on loving kindness, I don't know, 90% of it is how to work with anger. How to work with anger. Anger being, as understood, I think that people who wrote the book considered anger to be the biggest obstacle to having love. Go ahead.
I have the kind of the opposite thing. I've been accused of being over empathetic, and it gets me into trouble because I can usually always see the other person's side, and I lean in that direction, and something gets mixed up there that's not, it's not healthy, or I don't know why I'm doing it. I don't know if it's projection or what it is, but do you have any insight into kind of where to work on that it's too easy to?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, generally, people consider empathy to be a nice virtue, a nice emotion to have. But if empathy involves over-identification with someone else, then we can get in trouble. You know, we can, I mean, to if empathy means feeling the suffering of someone else, we might be of no help to anyone if we're having the same suffering as them, because just because we're next to them. they don't need that. Both be miserable together. So I think empathy, to over-identification, over kind of absorbing it is not useful. But to have some kind of sense or inner sense or inner experience of recognition, oh, that person's suffering. And the recognition of it, while we can stay stable, relaxed, open, but not taking it on or not letting it be fill or who we are, that's a more, I think, more useful kind of empathy that then has space for us to, hopefully from a strong place, a kind of an independent place maybe, to be able then to recognize and sympathize and be there with them and kind of empathize to some degree, but don't get lost in their experience. Yes.
This is on, right? Yeah. You were talking about these four different faces, and you said something about, well, toward the end, about it's an inner strength or an inner joy. I don't know if you said joy, but you had also mentioned joy at one point, that this is a way of, I guess, with equanimity, coming towards every situation, even the person that's your enemy. Could you talk more about this quality of joy?
Okay. I could. I guess I will. the hesitation about it is that I could give a whole, I could spend the next hour talking about joy. I could spend the next hour talking about joy to even scratch the surface of the topic. But the primary joy that's directly associated with these four Brahmaviharas is a third one, which is sympathetic joy or appreciative joy. So if I see you and you're just really happy, maybe even for no reason at all, imagine that, Abraham. And and then you come and you see me, and I say to you, you'll get over it. it's impermanent. Everything's impermanent. I'll give you a dose of wisdom. that would have one result. But if you come and you're so happy and for no reason at all, just you're settled and happy, and I see your wonderful face smiling, and I just like, wow, great. And I feel, this is wonderful, and I just celebrated with you. I feel joy, that you feel joy, and it's contagious, and I like to share it with you, and let's celebrate, let's appreciate this. So that's the appreciative joy that we can have. There's other forms of joy that can be connected to this kind of, and that is that it can be joyful to know that we're not easily going to fall into anger or fall into resentment or greed or lust. The Brahmaviharas are considered protections. They're considered to be very profound. They protect you in many ways. And so if you can live in this kind of way, you're protected from all kinds of problems that might run into. And there's a certain kind of joy or gladness to know, wow, I'm safe. There's a strength here. There's an ability to negotiate the world this way. And there's a certain safety. And so that we appreciate that safety. That's a joy. And then there's the meditative joy. And that is that if you can get stable and concentrated and focused, and so that the entire field of your attention is only about one of these loves, anytime you get concentrated, then there are concentration factors that get awoken. And there can be very strong states of joy and happiness that arise, not so much because of the joy of the love, but because of the concentration on the love. But then it's kind of sublime that these strong states of concentrated joy are mixed with love together. That's pretty sweet. It makes us even more joyful. So these are good things. So that's something. Is that enough?
That's three.
Yeah.
Good, no, it's great.
Let's just rejoice in those three. Let's rejoice in those three. So I saw one more hand somewhere. Yes.
Is this on?
Yeah.
Great, thanks. Earlier this year, you kind of left us with a provocation to be a refuge for others.
Uh-huh.
And that was a really compelling idea to me, because it kind of resonates with this idea, an ideal that I have of who I'd like to be. And just now also this big fiery furnace of emitting this heat for others as well, where you're not deficit-oriented and looking to get that love back. was wondering if you could comment on how to balance aspiring to those ideals of providing refuge or being that fiery furnace with also meeting your own emotional needs
nice.
In practice.
Yeah, nice question. I think any time there's, I mean, religions, and Buddhism, you know, does it too, has a lot of wonderful ideals. And sometimes it's wiser not to pursue the ideals, but to understand what gets in the way of them. Because if you understand what gets in the way, and you can drop those or resolve those, then you're available for the world without those blockages. And without those blockages, it might turn out the ideal you're pursuing is not what the situation calls for. But now you're more available, more adaptable to provide what is needed. Does that make sense? So one of the ways to start answering your question is look at all the ways all the things you do that get in the way. And then after you look at that for a while, maybe you'll learn something about the ideal that's kind of, you know, more your own. Does that seem okay as an answer? Great, thank you. Great, so it is not unrealistic to love. I think it's a profound thing to do. It can come from a tremendous place of strength and wisdom. And it's for the betterment of yourself and the world. And to give Abraham a fourth kind of joy is that if you have goodwill for others, they benefit, hopefully, and you benefit as well. It's a mutual benefit that goes on. So what a great thing to do. It's a wonderful path, the path of joy. And I would say that if I speak about it from personal experience, I found it to be tremendously meaningful for me in my life, these kinds of love, and it's kind of like a reference point that I use, quite often, for how to live, how to be, how to try to figure out how do I be with this situation, with this person now, and in a way that has integrity, but it's there, you know, in the question. And it was a long time coming to learn this. It wasn't something that I learned easily and quickly, but something over these years that I've been practicing slowly, I began to understand it and value it. And I'm sure I could have learned it quicker if I had sense enough to really apply myself to it, but I didn't. So it happened slowly over time, slowly as I did this practice. And I just feel like it's been one of the great treasures of my life and my practice to have this. And I'd like to suggest that don't be as slow about it as I was. It's well worth developing, well worth focusing on and learning. So thank you all very much.